And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a girl becomes the first in Oregon confirmed with a dangerous inflammatory condition in kids linked to COVID-19. Dozens of new cases of the virus are reported in Oregon, and efforts to help the visually impaired vote in next Tuesday's Oregon primary. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, May 14th, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. Governor Kate Brown announced today that 28 counties have been approved to begin phase one of the governor's gradual reopening plan. KBOO's Melissa Hood has more.
Deschutes, Lane, Jackson, and 25 other counties have been approved to begin slowly reopening their economies beginning tomorrow, May 15th. Beginning last week, Oregon counties were able to submit applications outlining plans to gradually reopen. The plans were required to meet specific health criteria, including a decline of COVID-19 levels over 14 days, a certain level of testing and contact tracing capability, hospital surge capacity, quarantine facilities and personal protection equipment, and guidelines from the state to individual businesses. After counties are approved, they can begin to allow certain personal service providers to reopen under industry-specific guidelines, including bars and restaurants, retail stores, outdoor recreation, and salons. Applications from Jefferson, Morrow, and Umatilla counties are still being reviewed. Multnomah, Washington, and Clackamas counties have not yet submitted plans to gradually reopen. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Melissa Hood.
Dozens more new COVID-19 cases are added to Oregon's official count, including new deaths. A child in Oregon becomes the first confirmed with a dangerous pediatric inflammatory condition linked to the virus, and a nursing home in Portland faces a wrongful death lawsuit connected to the disease. KBOO's Annette Newell has these and more stories in this local COVID-19 update.
Today, the Oregon Health Authority added another 67 confirmed COVID-19 cases and 3 new deaths to the toll statewide. That pushes the number of people testing positive for the virus in Oregon to more than 3,400 since March. The disease is linked to at least 137 deaths officially, with experts saying the real count is much higher. 685 Oregonians have been hospitalized with the illness. A 14-year-old girl is in intensive care at a Portland Children's Hospital, getting treatment for an inflammatory illness that doctors link to COVID-19. Doctors at Legacy Emmanuel Hospital System, which operates the Randall Children's Hospital, confirm the girl has pediatric inflammatory multisystem syndrome. She had symptoms including reddened eyes, head and stomach aches, fever, and shortness of breath. She also had low blood pressure, and the infection affected her heart. Doctors say she is getting better, and they expect her to survive. They found COVID-19 antibodies in her system. Oregon's medical director for communicable diseases says the syndrome appears to be a serious complication of COVID-19 in children. This is the first documented case of the syndrome in Oregon. Cases of the illness have also been appearing in kids in Washington, California, Connecticut, and New York, where some children have died from it. According to the state, 30 kids younger than 10 have caught the coronavirus in Oregon, and at least another 110 between the ages of 10 to 19 have become infected. A nursing home in Portland faces a $1.8 million wrongful death lawsuit. Healthcare at Foster Creek is the nursing home where almost 30 people have died after getting infected with COVID-19. The daughter of Judith Joy Jones, who was a 75-year-old resident of the care facility, has filed the lawsuit against St. Jude Operating Company, which owns the nursing home, and Benicia Senior Living, which managed it. It accuses them of negligence leading to Jones' death. It says on April 18th, a nurse found Jones had a fever, and she went to an emergency room, was diagnosed with COVID-19, but did not survive. The lawsuit accuses the defendants of not informing residents or their families of the results of COVID-19 tests, downplaying the risk, and lying about their safety practices. In April, the state released an inspection report at the facility, which said workers did not wash their hands or maintain proper social distance and lacked training in how to slow the spread of infection. The state ordered the Southeast Portland nursing home to shut down earlier this month. For the KBOO Evening News, I'm Annette Newell.
Despite soaring revenues from pandemic grocery shoppers, supermarket company Kroger announced it will end the additional $2 per hour hero bonus for its workers on Sunday, May 17th. The company announced the hero bonus for essential employees on March 31st, saying it planned the wage boost to last through mid-May. Today, a Kroger spokesperson said the company has invested more than $700 million to aid associates and safeguard customers and communities during the crisis, and had increased its workforce by over 100,000 since March. The supermarket chain also noted it had been supplying workers with personal protective equipment, enhanced sanitation protocols, reduced hours, and testing and extra health care benefits to employees showing symptoms of COVID-19 and to workers' families affected by the virus. Even with these measures, multiple Kroger workers have died from the novel coronavirus across the nation. Worker and public reaction to the halting of the hero bonus has been strong, with many saying it should remain as the pandemic and shelter-in-place orders remain ongoing. Kroger disclosed this week that CEO Rodney McMullen received a 3.6% raise for 2019, taking home over $14 million. United Food and Commercial Workers Union presidents from Kentucky, Indiana, Michigan, and Ohio wrote to McMullen, urging the company to extend its hero pay benefits, quote, as long as we face a global pandemic. Kroger rebutted, saying the next move is to plan a return to normal and start the path of recovery. Union spokespeople are saying this agenda does not reflect the reality of the increasing numbers of those infected and dying across the country. A UFCW president wrote to McMullen, quote, there is no path of recovery from a virus that has no cure. The Jupiter Next Hotel has been at the forefront of helping Portlanders during the coronavirus pandemic. At the beginning of the outbreak, the hotel became a safe haven for houseless people who were sick with the virus and needed to self-isolate. While Multnomah County has not yet applied for reopening, the Jupiter Next has a plan to help the community for client-based or service-based small businesses that are facing financial instability and possible closures. KBOO's Tammy Hauteas spoke with Jupiter's general manager, Nick Pearson, to hear more about how this will be made possible.
I think primarily it's really built into our brand ethos. You know, kind of the obvious step for us to see how we could be helpful and useful to the community that's kind of grown up around us here on East Burnside Street. Working with the county, we already made the decision that we were going to at least temporarily cease operations at the original Jupiter Hotel and just move everything over to Next, kind of reduce our operational footprint. So when the county expressed interest in it, that was kind of an easy win-win for, you know, a public-private partnership and keep a pulse on what people are feeling and expecting here as we get ready to reopen. And I've just been in touch with my barber throughout. I've been getting my hair cut from him for 10 years. So there's some good rapport there. And him and the shop owner at Bart's Barbershop down on Morrison were saying that it's going to be really hard for a lot of these small shops, especially to reopen at full capacity due to the physical distancing requirements. So it really, from there, we just kind of started a loose conversation about, you know, how could we help? And, you know, we talked through some ideas of could people cut hair in hotel rooms? And then we kind of said, you know, we have this giant 5,000 foot empty event space on the second floor that, you know, we're not going to be having events in for the foreseeable future. And so we started having conversations with a couple shops and got the health licensing office on board through the OHA and have a rough plan for how it can work whenever Multnomah County reopens.
Well, that's pretty amazing. And so you started off with helping out the county with folks that were houseless and also suffering from the coronavirus, right? And now you're taking it to the next level, kind of like tangent with people's financial issues that they're facing and how you can help out small businesses. So how would this look like? Is this something that you started already physically, or is this something that you're just advertising to the community?
Advertising to the community. So it is not legally allowed to start until personal services are given the go-ahead to reopen in Multnomah County. So Multnomah County actually hasn't applied for reopening under Governor Brown's guidelines. I think they're hoping to apply in the next 2 weeks. And so once there is a date set in stone, that's when will apply for the health license because shops will have the ability to operate at the Jupiter for 30 days under the temporary licensing. And so community who've supported us over the years, people go into barbershops, they, you know, and tattoo parlors and the like, and they make small talk. And, you know, a lot of these people have been, oh, you got a friend coming into town, send him to the Jupiter down the street. So it was pretty cool to be able to return the favor. And again, just make a win-win. We have a, you know, we're running low occupancy. Our event spaces are all empty. So just to get a little life and energy in the building and be able to help our neighbors was pretty cool to see come to fruition.
Well, as your neighbors here at KBOO, y'all just really up the street, we're overjoyed and that we're able to, you know, get the word out. So if people are interested in linking up, how do they go about that?
Yeah, best bet is to email myself directly, Nick, N-I-C-K, at jupiterhotel.com. And then we can kind of walk through the details and the plans that OHA and the licensing office is best practices. But essentially how it would work is that any individual shop who wants to have some space at the Jupiter would file for one of these permits, and it more or less becomes an extension of their shop. So they can have their employees, they can have their independent contractors come and work at the Jupiter, but it would be as if they're part of Northwest Barbers Association or Bart's Barbershop or any of the local shops right in our neighborhood. From there, it would be kind of like normal. The appointments would have to be scheduled directly with their barbers or the shops. Walk-ins won't be allowed under Governor Brown's plan. So, you know, we'll be following all of the guidelines put in place for personal services and just working hand in hand with the shop operators to, you know, make it as clean and sanitary and seamless of reopening experience as possible. You know, talking to some of these shop owners when you're, you know, behind 2 months on rent because you've been forced to close and then to have to reopen with a reduced capacity to generate revenue, you're staring down the barrel of a gun there. So being able to, you know, give them a lifeline and hopefully do something, you know, cool in the neighborhood through this strange times was certainly felt good for us, and it felt good for the barbers we were working with. So
thank you so much, Nick. I appreciate it.
Yeah, cheers. Have a great evening.
That was KBOO's Tammy Hobteis talking to Nick Pearson, the general manager of the Jupiter Next Hotel. As communities across the state get ready to reopen, they are facing new challenges. KBOO's Jeffrey Wade takes a look at the troubles in Old Town.
Retailers in Portland's Old Town District are voicing concerns over reopening, given the green light to open doors on Friday. Many downtown businesses have people camping in their doorways as the homeless population has grown and incidences of aggression and drug trafficking are increasingly more common. Store owners fear that customers will be put off by piles of garbage and fecal matter littering the neighborhood, not to mention confrontations with potentially volatile individuals. Helen Ying, chair of the Old Town Community Association, cited numerous incidents and photos of the sprawl in an email sent to Mayor Ted Wheeler's office this week. Alerted to these concerns, Police Chief Jamie Resch has put in place a 30-day high-visibility program for Old Town, with stepped-up police presence on bikes, in cars, and on foot. As the coronavirus sweeps through Portland, the city halted the cleanup of homeless camps due to health concerns and safety. Though police calls to the area have remained lower than usual, police officials say it's due to many of the businesses are shuttered due to COVID-19, and far fewer pedestrians are visiting Old Town as a result. Homeless shelters and other social service providers in the area have also noted a spike in tents and a heightened state of aggression from members of the population. Scott Kerman, executive director of Blanchett House, a nonprofit providing clothes, food, and housing to those in need, told Oregon Live, quote, "Everything was more or less pretty chill. That's changed a lot under the current situation. We do have elements coming in here just looking to cause trouble," end quote. Similar sentiments were shared by Lansu Chinese Garden Executive Director Jane DeMarco, who cited growing numbers of campers outside the garden's entrance, along with increased amounts of garbage and human waste evident both outside and inside the garden's walls. In addition to ramped-up police presence, members of the Police Behavioral Health Unit will also be stepping in to help connect people living on the streets to social services. These measures have received positive feedback from Old Town business owners, but for long-term fixes, retailers are urging the city to bring together social service providers as well as homeless advocacy groups such as Street Roots and Sisters of the Road to organize a collectively coordinated approach. For the KBOO Evening News, I'm Jeffrey Wade.
Next Tuesday is primary election day in Oregon, but even with a vote-by-mail system that's more accessible than many other states, those who are vision impaired can still have trouble voting, especially during the COVID-19 outbreak. Eric Tegedoff reports on the barriers they face and how they can overcome them.
Oregon's vote-by-mail system is earning praise during the coronavirus pandemic, but some Oregonians still will need help to get their vote counted. Disability Rights Oregon Deputy Legal Director Tom Stenson says people who are blind or have low vision usually get assistance filling out their ballots from the local county clerk's office, with staff sometimes coming to folks' houses.
I'm concerned that voters who are blind or low vision will have a harder time getting the kind of assistance that they need because of restrictions or concerns about the virus.
Stinson says his organization is thinking of next Tuesday's primary as a trial run for the general election, when coronavirus might still be impacting the state. Disability Rights Oregon will be documenting what works and what doesn't so the system can be improved before November. Stenson says people who are blind or have low vision are more likely to rely on family or friends because of the virus.
But I'm sure there are people who will need assistance, and I'm hoping that counties will do their best to provide it using as limited contact as possible, using PPE where it's available, to make sure that people who need assistance in voting can get it.
Stenson adds that the state is successfully maximizing the number of people that vote in its elections.
Oregon has a great system, but it's not a perfect system. We're constantly looking for ways to improve it.
Election officials say people should mail their primary ballots by today to ensure they get in by Election Day. They can also deliver them to drop boxes through Tuesday. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Secretary of State candidate in the Democratic primary, Shamia Fagan. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio, then at 8, Soul to Soul. Tonight's weather will be showers through the night, down to a low of 50. Tomorrow's weather, morning clouds, give way to afternoon sun and a high of 70. Today in history, on this date in 1804, Lewis and Clark started up the Missouri River to begin their expedition exploring the lands of the West. The quote of the day is from Meriwether Lewis, who said, quote, "I could but esteem this moment of my departure as among the most happy of my life." Senator Richard Burr is reportedly stepping down as chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee while being investigated by the FBI. The FBI is looking at the North Carolina senator's stock trades after he sold his stocks following briefings on COVID-19 in February. The FBI has issued a search warrant against Burr and retrieved his phone, according to officials. Jack Sharman, a white-collar defense lawyer who was special counsel to the House Financial Services Committee, said taking the phone probably means agents are looking for texts and calls from Burr's to his brokers and his financial advisors and the exact time of those communications. According to Sharman, if the timing of the communication is right and the agents can find the information, Burr could be in trouble for insider trading. The 2012 Stock Act was designed to prevent members of Congress from trading on information that only they have. Burr has recently said he made his trades based on CNBC reporting and not from exclusive lawmaker briefings. He has said his term as the senior United States Senator from North Carolina, which ends in 2022, will probably be his last. Four so-called faithless electors took their cases to the U.S. Supreme Court. And even after the largest voting right expansion in a long time, many returning citizens are not sure whether they're eligible, though a federal judge is likely to rule in their favor. With more on that story, here's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
The question is, can states have laws on the books that require or compel electors to vote for who the state picked in the vote?
Colorado Public Radio Justice reporter Allison Sherry breaks down the case the Supreme Court considered yesterday. Figuring out what role the Constitution wants electors to have is complicated.
When people think about the presidential election, they think of themselves voting for president. However, the reality is that what you are voting for is a slate of electors.
Fair Vote Law and Policy Director Drew Penrose says it's extremely rare for the 538 electors to cast their Electoral College ballots for anyone other than the candidate who won their state's popular vote.
However, there are abnormal circumstances under which an elector might decide to vote differently. And the common term for electors who vote for somebody other than their party's nominee is a faithless elector.
Four so-called faithless electors were part of a last-ditch effort to prevent Donald J. Trump from winning the Electoral College. Hoping to swing over some Republicans, three Democratic electors in Washington state wrote in Colin Powell, and one in Colorado went for John Kasich. The Washington electors were fined $1,000 each. The Colorado elector, Michael Baca, was replaced. His argument is that the Constitution allows that freedom, that the founders designed the Electoral College so that electors could change the results if they felt the voters got it wrong. CPR Sherry interviewed Baca and says that's one reason why Baca wants the Electoral College eliminated.
He's trying to point out that the Electoral College is super undemocratic, that it has the potential to create what he would call 538 Michael Bacas to decide who's president of the United States instead of the people of the United States.
The Electoral College is meant to prevent larger states from having an outsized impact on the presidential election. Because most states use the winner-take-all tradition, slim margins of critical swing states will determine the outcome. Florida is the largest of these pivotal states, and 2020 is the first presidential election since Florida voters passed Amendment 4, reinstating the right to vote for hundreds of thousands of people with past felony convictions. Many of those are still unsure whether they're eligible. Republican lawmakers passed a law requiring all court fees and fines to be paid before a returning citizen can register to vote. District Judge Robert Hinkle has indicated he will rule to strike down the law because there's no statewide system to record their payments. The federal trial finished up last week. Hinkle intends to rule in time for the August primaries and November election.
What we've seen over time is a little bit of a roller coaster for what we call the returning citizen community in Florida.
Neil Voltz is the deputy director of the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition, the major force behind Amendment 4.
Passage of Amendment 4 was a watershed moment. It's the biggest expansion of democracy in the United States in the last 50 years. And it also means that we need to keep fighting to make sure that people can get registered.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
The Oregon Zoo's newest addition was introduced to her family this week. A 2-year-old Maasai giraffe kitten met the zoo's other giraffes, Buttercup and Daisy, on Tuesday. Kitten arrived in Oregon last month after leaving South Carolina's Greenville Zoo, where she was born in January of 2018. Oregon Zoo Deputy Director Sherry Harizny said the zoo was reluctant to pursue Kitten's transfer due to economic strains brought on by COVID-19, though plans to relocate the giraffe had been in the works for months prior, until a donor fully funded the move. Harizny said in a statement last week, quote, "It was incredibly generous in response to the Oregon Zoo Foundation donation, and that, quote, the window for transfers is small, and this move is significant for the species' survival." Kitten comes to Oregon as part of the Association for Zoos and Aquariums Species Survival Plan, a cooperative program among zoos helping to create genetically diverse, self-sustaining populations of animals, helping guarantee the long-term survival of various species. With a decline in population over 50%, the Maasai subspecies of giraffe is endangered. Less than 33,000 animals remain in their native home of eastern Africa. Kitten spent a few weeks acclimating to her new surroundings before being introduced to Buttercup and Daisy this week. She is, quote, right at home, along with the Spex gazelles and ground hornbills that share their mixed species habitat. The Oregon Zoo is currently closed to the public in efforts to slow the spread of COVID-19, so giraffe fans will have to wait a bit to see Kitten live in person. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, May 14th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Jeffrey Wade, Melissa Hood, and Tammy Hobteas. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff and Lily Bolke. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our listeners. If you would like to support our programming, go to kboo.fm/give, or you can use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth, where we'll be speaking with Democratic primary candidate for Secretary of State, Shamia Fagan.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
The Democratic primary ballot for the May 19th election will feature three candidates for Secretary of State: Mark Haas, Jamie McLeod Skinner, and Shamia Fagan. Fagan is an Oregon native growing up in Duffer and the Dalles. Currently, she serves as a state senator representing District 24, which encompasses Southeast Portland, Happy Valley, Milwaukee, and North Clackamas. Fagan also works as a civil rights attorney, and she has scored endorsements from Planned Parenthood, the Oregon Education Association, and the League of Conservation Voters, among others. We spoke with Fagan to learn more about election security, small business support, and her priorities for Oregon. Well, to get started, what inspired you to run for Secretary of State?
Well, I think that Oregonians deserve a Secretary of State who has not only taken on tough fights here in Oregon, but won them. And I'm the only candidate in the race who has spent the past decade at the forefront of every major voter expansion in Oregon, from automatic voter registration, which I started working on my very first term in the Oregon House, to most recently entering us into the National Popular Vote Compact, as well as passing prepaid postage. So a lot of Oregonians will notice that on their ballots this time, they don't have to put a stamp on there if they plan on mailing it in, because we have prepaid postage. I'm the only person running who sponsored that legislation just last year in the Senate. So I've been working on expanding voting rights my entire legislative career. But right now, our democracy is under attack. It's more so than it ever has been. We have the president outspending tens of millions of dollars in lawsuits to try to stop the expansion of vote by mail. He's coming for vote by mail. And I think that Oregonians need a Secretary of State who has a history of standing up for the Oregon way of doing things and winning those fights.
And Oregon Secretary of State is a position that wears a lot of hats in state government compared to, you know, secretaries of state in other states. The secretary oversees elections, audits, public records, the Business Services and Corporations Division, as well as sitting on the state land board. But the responsibility for overseeing elections is often what first comes to people's minds. What do you see as the biggest threat to our electoral security currently, and how would you like to address that?
We are lucky here in Oregon that we have very secure elections. We use paper ballots. Our vote counting machines are not online. The biggest technical threat is through our online voter registration system. We need to shore up the security around our online voter registration system. That's where our biggest vulnerability is in a literal sense. But the reality is, in a day and age where people can share stuff on social media and misinform people, really misinformation is the biggest kind of, when you really look at the broad sense of the threats to our democracy, because you don't have to actually hack a voting machine or actually interfere in an election if you can just spread misinformation and make people believe that you did. And so one very underutilized office in the Secretary of State's office that I want to significantly bulk up is the office the Director of Civic Education. And if your listeners have even heard of this office, they might think of like elementary school curriculum or the Kid Governor program. But we need re-education for all Oregonians about how to spot misinformation, how to check to make sure their news sources are credible, Because the reality is I'm more likely to get misinformation via text or social media from my aunt than I am from my niece, because she grew up in a generation where, you know, if it looked like Walker Cronkite said it or ABC News said it, then it was true. But she'll often send me stuff that will look really alarming, but she won't have caught that the website is like one letter off or two letters off from a credible website. So I think that we need to really bulk up the director of civic education, because part of our civic life is making sure that we're using credible information, that we're at least sharing the same set of facts, so that when we, you know, engage in civic discourse and civic dialogue, we're at least operating on the same set of basic facts and true facts.
And how could we implement that, I guess, in a concrete sort of way?
Yeah, well, there's, like I said, in the Secretary of State's executive team, there already exists a position, the Director of Civic Education. And so we essentially need a campaign to show folks. I mean, there's actually some curriculums in other states that they've introduced that have been really successful in kind of helping people spot misinformation, spot news story, you know, like incorrect news stories, or and not, you know, news, credible news outlets making a mistake. We're talking about the intentionally false information that gets spread on social media. And they're essentially, they've developed a whole curriculum around helping people spot that and, you know, use, you know, social media campaigns and other type of things to get that information out to Oregonians, because that position already exists in the Secretary of State's executive team. It's just not being used right now for anything beyond kind of elementary school curriculum and the Kid Governor program. We can use that position a lot more.
So before you were a state senator, you worked as a civil rights attorney. How did that work help to inform your life in politics?
I still am a civil rights attorney, so I'm actually...
Excuse me.
Yeah, no worries. Oregon has a citizen legislature, so when we're in session, we're full-time legislators. When we're out of session, most of us, or a lot of us, go back to our day jobs. So I'm still a civil rights attorney, and what I do primarily is stand up for workers in the workplace who are being mistreated, wage theft, race discrimination, sexual harassment, sex discrimination, pregnancy discrimination. And it essentially made me realize that there are... You know, look, there are mistakes that folks make, that small businesses make, that are not, they're not looking to hurt their workers. An honest mistake that can, you know, quickly get an honest remedy. But there are bad actors out there that do try to cut corners, which not only cheats their workers, but it cheats other small businesses who are actually doing the right thing. And so my very first bill that I chief co-sponsored, my freshman legislative session, created the Office of Small Business Assistance in the Secretary of State's office. And that is an office that still exists there today and receives not only national but international acclaim of how well Oregon does in assisting small businesses through that small business advocate. And so right now, more than ever, as we're trying to get our economy going again, 95% of Oregon businesses are small businesses. That is the engine of the Oregon economy. And small businesses need to understand and realize that they have an advocate inside the Secretary of State's office that is there to give them resources, help them sort through information, and treat their employees and their vendors in accordance with the law and give them information about how to do that.
Yeah, that was actually going to be my next question, talking about the Business Services and Corporations Division, as well as a Small Business Ombudsman, and using those positions to help businesses adapt to and recover from the coronavirus restrictions that we've been dealing with. What specifically would you enact with that power?
Well, the Secretary of State doesn't have legislative authority to enact, you know, legislation, for example, but a small business advocate, Ruth Miles is her name. She actually was a chief of staff to a legislator when I was in the House, and then she went on to run, actually, I believe she runs the Corporations Division right now, but she used to be the small business advocate. But the reality is it's literally a clearinghouse, almost like a 211 type number for small businesses. So it's not one specific policy or another. They're essentially hey, come to me with any questions, because oftentimes a small business will get a letter saying, hey, you're not in compliance here. You have to pay this fee here. And those are the kind of questions that go directly to the Office of Small Business Assistance. And I know right now they're overrun with people trying to get access to the Paycheck Protection Act. How do I apply? How do I go through my bank? How do I reapply if I didn't get in on the first round of funding or the second round of funding? And so that person really keeps their job broad to really act in any situation as a clearinghouse of information that small businesses need here in Oregon. And the Corporations Division, there's all kinds of stuff we can. I mean, it's essentially a licensing, and it's a registered agent to make sure that folks are licensed with the state. The enforcement and stuff does not come through. That's more through the Department of Consumer and Business Services, DCBS. But One thing that we can do, just a quick equity fix, is I've learned through, I've been supported by PACUN, the Latinx Farm Workers Union, and one thing that I learned from engaging with them and other communities that don't speak English as a first language is all of the corporate forms in Oregon are only in English. And so there's simple changes that we can make to make sure that when we have an economic recovery in Oregon, that's an economic recovery for everyone and not just for folks that can only that speak English. And so there's all kinds of things like that that we can do, even though the corporate division is really kind of there to kind of receive registrations and make sure that everyone's, you know, registered agent information is out in the public and transparent for everyone. But we can still enact equity there to make sure that the recovery is good for every small business in Oregon through those equity type moves.
What is one issue in this race that you think doesn't get enough attention?
Well, I previously mentioned the director of civic education. That's kind of a drum that I've been beating since I got into this race with misinformation. But in addition to that, our public records. I'm the only one in this race who's proposed going beyond. So the Public Records Advisory Council, or they had some recommendations. We adopted those in the Senate in the February session. Of course, I voted for that. It was unanimous, and that was not controversial. But there are other places that we can change our public records laws to make the work we do in Salem more transparent. And one place that I pushed back on my own party, which I'm sure you can imagine is hard to do, is the Senate Democratic Caucus essentially utilizes a secret ballot as how they kind of discuss votes, whether they're going to be enough votes of just Democrats to pass legislation. And that secret ballot is on paper, but it's exempt from public records law. So I have proposed closing this, what I call secret ballot loophole, because what often happens is if a bill or an idea or a policy doesn't receive enough votes on that secret ballot of just Democrats, it never even goes on to a committee or onto the Senate floor to receive a public vote. And I think it's pretty simple to say that the public business done by public officials should be done in public here in Oregon.
Have you found that there's issues in the campaign that are commonly misunderstood by voters?
I think the biggest concern with voters and the Secretary of State's office is folks just often don't know what the Secretary of State's office does. And I always ask when I encounter folks, I say, look, that's not on you. That's on us. It's on the leaders in Oregon to make the work that we do relevant to people's lives. It's not on them to get a political science degree on the side of raising kids, taking care of families, opening a business, you know, taking care of their folks, whatever. This is something that's on us. In fact, my own brothers, I grew up in Eastern Oregon. I'm from Duffer and the Dalles, and my brothers continued east and now live in Stanfield and Pendleton, and one's a diesel mechanic and one's a welder. And when I told my big brothers, we're all very close, they were so proud of me, and then the next beat they were like, I don't even know what the Secretary of State does. And I was like, no worries. And so we actually did a podcast for my campaign called On the Oregon Trail with Shamia. In the very first episode, the title is, quote, I'm embarrassed to ask, but what does the Secretary of State do? And it's a conversation with me and my two big brothers. And I walk them through exactly what the Secretary of State does. And I kind of ask an open-ended question at the beginning saying, hey, what do you think the Secretary of State does? And one of my brothers says, I don't know, the state secretary, like, gets coffee and stuff. And obviously he was being, you know, he was joking, but he was also showing that, like, yeah, a lot of people don't know what this office does. And it's on us to make the work that we do relevant to people's lives. It's been a big focus of mine as a state house member, as a state senator, to make the work we do accessible, to not use confusing language about committees and bill numbers and, you know, minority reports and all these technical terms, but to break it down and make it accessible to people so they're not intimidated by the government that is their government, right, of the people, by the people. And I will continue to do that accessibility as Secretary of State.
So the Secretary of State, as you mentioned a little bit before, is also in charge of approving the wording of ballot measures, which is really important because the language between a yes and a no can be very confusing. Last week, Willamette Week reported on an email sent from your state Senate colleague, Representative Alyssa Kenny Geyer, criticizing a political action committee that supports you called Oregonians for Ballot Access, which she said was misleading in what it's called. What is your response to that? What is the importance of clear wording?
Yeah, well, clear wording is important. And, you know, obviously I've worked with Rep. Kitty Geyer. She's supporting one of my opponents. So her email was not obviously neutral. It was in an effort to support somebody that I'm running against. But the website, my campaign, didn't develop it or work on it, but I did review it. And if it was inaccurate, I would have asked them to take it down. But it's essentially a website that lists all the endorsements received from organizations, including endorsements I didn't receive. So my opponents, if they got an endorsement that I didn't get, that's also listed on the website. It's not just endorsements I received. It's also endorsements my opponents received with, you know, a fat red X underneath my name for certain organizations and good organizations. And so, you know, obviously she had her own motives in sending that email because she's supporting one of my opponents. But the bottom line is nobody was able to point out any inaccuracies in the website. And if there was something inaccurate, I would ask that organization and those folks to take it down. But, you know, it was publicly available information, nothing negative about my opponents, and listed endorsements that everybody received, including ones my opponents received that I didn't receive.
In such a multifaceted race, what differentiates you from your opponents? I mean, you spoke to endorsements a little bit just then.
Oh, sure. I mean, that's, you know, look, this is a race where Democrats are going to potentially look at two or three of us and go, gosh, I like these people. And that's the same decision that was faced by the organizations that Democrats trust. And I'm proud that nearly every major Democratic organization and progressive organization has endorsed me in the race. Planned Parenthood, NARAL. Just today we got endorsed by Emily's List, which is a national organization that promotes pro-choice women candidates. Oregon League of Conservation Voters, the Oregon Education Association, the Oregon State Firefighters Council. And so all these organizations looked at all of us, and everybody in the race sought those endorsements and went before those folks and had their shot. But they all endorsed me because I've got a track record for standing up for everyday Oregonians, in part because of my background. And I didn't grow up with a silver spoon in my mouth. I grew up in Duffer and the Dalles. My dad raised me as a single parent. And my mom battled meth and heroin addiction and was homeless in Portland for most of my childhood and much of my adult life. She also battled addiction. And so they see my track record as being somebody who is willing to stand up for everyday Oregonians, who's always considering how a particular policy affects the most vulnerable among us, not just the most privileged among us. And those organizations looked at my track record, my voting record, and that I'm not just somebody that votes for something and then kind of turns my attention away, but I'm a champion for the issues that Oregonians care about, that working people in Oregon care about. And so I'm proud to be endorsed by the broadest, most geographically diverse, most grassroots organizations across the state that Democrats trust.
Thank you for that. Do you have any closing thoughts for our listeners today?
Just that folks need to make sure their ballots are received by Tuesday, May 19th. Which we're encouraging folks to just go ahead and drop that in a Dropbox because the mail has been a little bit slow in the metro area potentially. So we're just encouraging folks that to go drop those in a Dropbox. The ballot has to be received by 8 p.m. on Tuesday, May 19th, and I'm asking Oregon Democrats to vote for me for Oregon Secretary of State.
Shamia, thank you so much for talking with us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It was great.
We've been speaking with Shamia Fagan, state senator and Democratic primary candidate for Secretary of State. More information on Fagan and her campaign at shamiafororegon.com, S-H-E-M-I-A for Oregon.com. Primary ballots must be received by 8 p.m. on Tuesday, May 19th. Find a ballot drop box location near you by going to the Secretary of State's website, sos.oregon.gov/voting. For KBU News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
Elizabeth Shogren is a reporter for Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. CIR is a nonprofit news organization based in Emeryville, California, that has been conducting award-winning investigative journalism since 1977. Most recently, the organization has been honored as a Pulitzer Prize finalist and winner of the Hillman Prize, the Best of the West Award, and a prestigious Gracie Award. Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Elizabeth, you co-wrote a stunning article detailing the PPE, or personal protective equipment, shortage in the United States and spotlighted how, after pressure from numerous organizations, the CDC's decision to downgrade its PPE guidelines affected healthcare workers across the nation. You reported that as of May 6th, over 31,000 healthcare workers in the United States have been infected, with over 100 deaths. Can you talk to us a little bit about what you learned while researching and writing this incredibly important piece?
Well, thank you for reading it. And what we learned is that drew us to this story is that doctors and nurses at hospitals around the country were terrified because they didn't feel safe to do their jobs. And they didn't feel safe because their hospitals were telling them that it was okay to go in and take care of COVID-positive patients who might be coughing all over them, and the doctors and nurses would just be wearing a surgical mask, this kind of thin wisp of tissue that we wear over our mouths, lots of us, when we go to the grocery store. It was the protection that doctors and nurses were getting from their hospitals as well when this disease was all around them. And the doctors and nurses happened to be, you know, really smart people who understand science. That's what they're trained in when they're in school. And so they knew that the science was saying that COVID-19 was a disease that could be spread through the air and not just when you touch something. And so they were afraid that, because they know that these masks that we wear aren't really intended as personal protective devices. They're intended to protect, a surgeon might wear it so that the person who's getting the operation wouldn't get sick, you know, not the other way around. And so they were scared, and that drew us to the story. And of course, the other thing that drew us to the story is why hospitals were doing this. And of course, there was a shortage of these things. But the other reason was that the government, the federal Centers for Disease Control, they had set guidelines. And those guidelines had told hospitals that respirators, these N95 masks we know about, were the preferable protection for doctors and nurses. But if you didn't have them, surgical masks were okay, and acceptable is the word that they used. And that was a message that the federal government sent out on March 10th. Earlier, however, the federal government had a much more protective standard, which said you had to have N95 masks or other respirators for your staff at hospitals. So they had downgraded those guidelines. And what Jennifer Gollan and I wanted to know is, why did they do that? What happened? What was happening behind the scenes to make the Centers for Disease Control and the CDC downgrade its policy? And so that's what we went to find out. And so we went to find out two things, actually. Why did the CDC downgrade its guidelines, and also what was the impact of that on hospitals around the country and doctors and nurses? And so those were the two things we tried to get answers for.
Yeah, it's extremely frustrating that we have those respiratory protection standards, but then the CDC can, at an incredibly crucial moment, just roll them back. What do you think it says about the way our system is set up that the CDC decided to roll back guidelines, at least partly due to the fact that the hospitals didn't want to get fined for not having proper protections?
Well, I think that it shows that people and organizations with a lot of money have a lot of influence over our government, because we saw that the hospitals put an enormous amount of pressure on the CDC to roll back these guidelines. The hospitals also put an enormous amount of pressure on Congress when it was considering putting higher requirements for protective gear in a law. And it was, in fact, in the House version of the law, and then the hospitals, the Hospital Association put enormous amount of pressure on Congress to take it out before it was passed. And so that's clearly, it shows, I think, very clearly how much influence the hospitals have as a bloc, you know, as a political force, and that speaks very loudly and much more loudly than the groups, the unions, and other worker protection voices that there are that were desperately trying to prevent this from happening.
And you've talked about this a little bit, but why do you think the Trump administration has so vehemently declined to enact the Defense Production Act? which basically would require, from my understanding, businesses to make materials that are needed available, like masks and ventilators.
Well, they have used the Defense Production Act to some degree, even when it comes to surgical masks. But what they haven't done is to use it to kind of order the production of these masks at a broad scale. So it's a little more nuanced than just that they didn't use it at all. At first, they didn't use it, and there is a lot of criticism from lots of different sides that they haven't used it aggressively enough. It is a very interesting question, the why of it. I think it could reflect a little bit the philosophy of this White House that there's this idea that the president and the federal government in general isn't really responsible for the responding to the COVID crisis. It's much more a state-by-state thing. You know, we saw when New York was in pandemonium and President Trump was talking about how he'd done so much for New York, as if New York was almost another country. And I think there's a different philosophy among Republicans where it's a sense that the states are the most important political group and that they should have a lot of autonomy and a lot of authority and responsibility to care for their citizens more than the federal government, kind of the idea of a weaker central government and a stronger state government. And I think maybe that comes into play a little bit here.
And you mentioned unions a little bit ago. Do you think it becomes impossible for unions to protect their workers in cases like these?
You know, it's so interesting. I was speaking with one expert in she's an industrial hygienist, so her expertise is basically how do you protect workers? And she was telling me that she thinks that the hospitals for sure have let their staffs down, but she feels like that the unions also have let their members down, that the unions should have been organizing mass walkouts, that if the doctors and nurses had really banded together and said, this is unacceptable, we need basic protection, that voice would have been very strong. I'm not saying this is my view. This was her view. Her name is Lisa Brasseau. And she made a really interesting point, though, I think. And her point was that the Hippocratic Oath does not ask doctors and nurses to commit suicide, which is, in her view, what the doctors and nurses were being asked to do by their hospitals. And she felt like that the union should do more to stand up and protect them. I know unions have been doing some. I know they have been demanding more personal protective equipment, but I don't know if it's all that they could do. And I know that doctors and nurses feel a great deal of responsibility for all of us, right? They do a lot for us all the time. And of course, they don't want their patients to be sick or to face a deadly disease like this without their care. So they want to be there for us. But I was trying to imagine whether there was another time in our history when it was so dangerous to be a doctor or a nurse, and I can't think of one. And there is an expert we spoke with who, her name is Peg Seminario, and she for decades was a leader in worker protections at the AFL-CIO, at the big union, and she's so thoughtful. And one of the things that she said is through the decades that she represented workers, she never saw a time when worker protection was worse than it is right now. And she never saw a time when the federal government let down workers so much as they are right now. And I thought that was kind of stunning, you know, 40 years of this is what her expertise is. She's done that for 40 years, and she's never seen a time this bleak in any profession.
Yeah, and we're seeing that in unions and workers across the country in all fields.
It's true, and it's not just doctors and nurses who are facing risks without personal protective gear that they would need to be safe. I wanted to say something about the statistics, because I fear it's very easy when you put a number out there for that number to start to become very important, and there are caveats with that number. So we were able to get to obtain these numbers that are it's data provided to the CDC, and so this data is accurate that there were 31,000 healthcare workers who had been infected with COVID-19. But the important thing to know is that most of the data that comes to CDC doesn't indicate whether or not the COVID positive person is a healthcare worker or not. That only 1/6 of the data at one point when CDC did an analysis had that indication. So that number is dramatically underestimates the real number of healthcare workers who have COVID-19. So it was just 1/6 of the data that included whether or not somebody was a healthcare worker. So I can't tell you that what is the real number, but I know that 31,000 vastly underestimates it.
Wow. Are there any other closing thoughts you'd like to share with our listeners today?
I guess maybe my thought would be that one of the things that we found in our research is that it seemed to us and to the experts we talked to that the CDC guidance, when it diluted or watered down its guidance, that it was being swayed by the shortages and not by science. And I think that it's one thing that I've seen happen a lot in the federal government, that agencies that are supposed to be upholding science and telling us what is the best science, what does science tell us, instead make these big compromises and tell us what does industry want us to say. And so economics play a big role, where science should be playing a bigger role. And I don't know. I don't think I articulated that very well, but I just think that that's a really big question for us as a society, is how do we want to be guided by science? And in this case, about the science about how much protection workers, what kind of gear is necessary to protect doctors and nurses? Or do we want to be guided by economics, in this case, the shortages that there are of N95s and other respirators? I think it's a big question, and since it's our government, it's our choice.
Elizabeth, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thanks for being interested. I appreciate it.
Elizabeth Shogren is a reporter for Reveal covering science. She tracks the real-life effects of the anti-science mentality that has seeped into many corners of the federal government. You can read more at revealnews.org. Reporting for KBOO News in Depth, I'm Nat Moon.